Welcome to John Judge Lecture here at the Roxy Theater tonight, the subject being 9-1-1, Afghanistan and Iraq, and some of the history of the 20th century wars. The vagaries of the weather and the Washington schedules gave us a little bit of a late start tonight, and appreciate all those in attendance here that were patient. Those of us that have questions about Iraq and the upcoming scene with Iraq and what we're doing in Afghanistan at the moment and what we've done and how it relates to 9-1-1, if you've attempted to turn the pages beyond what you get on the mainstream media and swing out right or left, you soon discover that there's layers of information and layers of information again. And for the first four or five levels in either direction, left or right, it's prepared script. And this is the person that we have up here tonight with us that can take us beyond the prepared script and cut through it, leaving us with a profound and yet conversational ability to engage others and to resolve the mental turmoil that we can get at attempting to pursue the path of truth. Many of us want to turn on the television, many of us want to turn on a radio or pick up a newspaper and pick up some undiluted, unmixed information that we can integrate into our psyche and give accurate feedback to our representatives how we want them to act on that. Instead, what we find ourselves doing is discovering, much to our frustration and much to our anger a lot of times, and that we're being led and misled into corners of the psyche where they want us to sit. I think without further ado, I'm going to hand this over to John and leave it at that.
I just wanted to thank Mark because he's been putting out the energy and the juice to get speakers up here. Peter Del Scott preceded me, Bill Bloom, another very good researcher into the hidden histories and background of this government, is scheduled here. And I think he's doing a real service. It's unfortunate that we don't have the kind of crowds that we need, and I hope that folks, at least if you're local — I don't know where all of you are from, if you had to come in from out of town — but if you are local, would help him with getting these programs better advertised and attended, because there's a lot of information that people aren't getting in the current time period. I just got a chance to speak in Seattle in February of this year, and then more recently in San Francisco and Oakland. And I was able, finally, had to push my way in, but I got on the Pacifica station out in Oakland. And my whole talk was aired in two one-part series, and Dennis Bernstein had me on Flashpoints, a 50-minute interview. But when I first, when my friend who set it up for me to come and talk tried to get me on, there was a blockade, and I eventually found out that Chip Berlay, who does me no favors ever and constantly links me to the Michigan militia and the right wing and publications and things, had made a point to try to link me to Mike Rupert's work and on 9/11, and because Rupert had been slammed in The Nation, and because they don't like him out at that station, then they didn't want me to come and talk. But I know a lot of people connected with the station. I've been on the station many times over the years and connected with Pacifica, and also almost got a radio show in D.C. recently when they changed over station management. So I kind of called in some favors and managed to get on. But much of this kind of information, as many of us who do the research know, is shunned not only by the mainstream media, but by most of the alternative and left media as well. And there's so much information that that we really need to be working on that doesn't get out. So I just wanted to say thanks also to folks who put up with the weather and came out tonight. Some of you know me from the Coalition on Political Assassinations, which I helped co-found along with its member group committee for an open archives. I felt quite successful in getting the JFK records loose, 6 million pages to date, the largest release of classified information. And we just finally had a rescheduled, it was unscheduled because of September 11th last year, but a rescheduled panel at the Congressional Black Caucus Legislative Conference with Cynthia McKinney hosting that had Martin Luther King III, Judge Joe Brown, Dr. William Pepper, Jim Lazar, who had been an attorney for James Earl Ray. Judge Brown was the judge in his last trial. And also Phil Melanson, who's written about the case, Lyndon Barston, a current researcher into aspects of the case, and myself. And we're working very hard now with Cynthia McKinney's office before she has to go out of office to get a piece of legislation drafted that others can sign on to and carry that will create a Martin Luther King Assassination Records Act based on the JFK Act. And this would also release the COINTELPRO files, counterintelligence program files, and other files about the spying on the civil rights movement and things that led into King's assassination in the broader historical picture. And I think it's pertinent to do that now because COINTELPRO is being revived by General Ashcroft. So I continue doing that work. We're scheduled in November 22nd to 24th in Dallas to have a regional meeting of the coalition, and we're going to have a lot of good speakers there on all three assassinations, and also we're going to be talking about 9/11 there because last year we spoke about it. Peter Dale Scott called on the JFK research community to use their skills to look into 9/11, and I put up an email list, and have been distributing articles to those interested as a network called International Network of Deep Politics Researchers, which was sort of a nod to Peter Dale Scott's term, Deep Politics, or the acronym is In Deeper. And I've been following 9/11 since its inception. It was close enough to me in D.C. that it shook my windows when the plane hit. And I was quite amazed at what did and didn't happen that day. And the two things that I have focused on primarily beyond the background information, because I think these are the two areas that the administration and the national security system are most vulnerable on, are the events of that day, especially in Washington, D.C., or what I would call a military stand down on 9/11 in Washington, D.C., and somewhat nationally. And I'll go into that. And the other is the history of the anthrax investigation. And I was not enamored of the idea of asking, as some were, what did Bush know and when did he know it? I mean, I think the proper formation of that question would be, when was Bush told and how soon did he forget it? We know that Colin Powell, for instance, was informing India, Pakistan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and many of the surrounding countries in June of 2001 that the United States would militarily intervene against the Taliban in Afghanistan in mid-October to take them out. This is in June. We were also told on Tom Brokaw's ABC News that the war plans for Afghanistan were on Bush's desk on September the 9th. Well, what that says to me is some people were shocked, you know, Bush knew about the plan even before 9/11. What it says to me, though, is that Bush is out of the loop. Bush is the last to know, the last that would be told. And I think his comments about what happened to him that day on 60 Minutes, which I can also talk about, show to me that, you know, he really is literally out of the loop. And the standing joke in D.C. is if Cheney should have a heart attack, Bush could become president. That route of going after what did somebody know and when did they know it is futile because it's an internal question, and only if they admit to you what they knew and when did they know it could you actually establish it. There may be some cases where you have a document or a piece of correspondence that shows they should have known if they read it, if it was interagency. But the slippery slope of going that route in this discussion of 9/11, which is not to say that they could not have or should not have known in advance, and in many ways they could have known what might happen, at least, if not it was happening. But separate from that question, what we got instead is this congressional investigation by Porter Goss and Bob Graham in the intelligence committees in the two bodies of Congress, whose theme is that there was an intelligence failure. And I found it interesting that someone at the CIA was quoted in the news the other day sort of complaining that there hadn't been any intelligence failure for September 11th. And I don't think there was either, but that's the official line. And the effect of that is that instead of investigating what actually happened on September 11th and what its meaning is, we're now into an investigative mode that says that our intelligence communities need to be better financed, they need to be better coordinated, and they need to be expanded in terms of their powers. And this was a theme right after 9/11. In fact, the first commentary from the official heads at the CIA and elsewhere in the administration and recently out of it was to blame the Church Committee on for 9/11. The Church Committee being Frank Church's investigation that finally in the 1970s put a halt to and exposed some of the excesses of the FBI and the CIA and the U.S. intelligence community. So this was sort of to drive the final nail in the coffin. Some of the funds that Oliver North collected from the drug money, part of that was to put into campaign coffers of people in the U.S. who were specifically set up to run against the members of the Church Committee that next year and take them out of office. And many of them were eventually pushed out. But this is, I think, the final way for them to say that the CIA had been, and FBI had been, with a hand tied behind their back. They had been shackled by this this inability to hire assassins or do dirty work or cross their legal lines of whether they should spy on Americans. So all that, they kept saying that first week, we have to restore all these powers to the CIA and the intelligence agencies. Again, amusingly enough, one of the networks, I think it was CNN, went out and interviewed a top analyst at the CIA, and his response was, these people are misled, we don't need those authorities. Well, they don't need them because they do what they're going to do anyway. And it's sort of like going to a hitman and saying, hey, we're going to make you legal. And the hitman's going to say, shh, you're going to blow my cover. Because as long as I'm not legal, I've got plausible deniability. But if you say I'm legal, then everything that happens is going to be blamed on me. And I think this is all part of a much broader scheme. I talked about this in 1996 in Los Angeles. I did a talk called Are You Scared Yet? And the subtitle was Phony Terrorism, Counterterrorism, and the Strategy of Tension, which is a term from the European model where the state security agencies create terrorist incidents, hire out people to do the terrorist incidents, blame them on one side or the other of the political spectrum, and use it to increase state repression. A good model where that was more recently used of what's happening here in the United States, if you want a model for what's evolving, would be Peru, where Mr. Mancini from the CIA connections and Fujimori, who was the president, were eventually kicked out on scandals. But while they were in, using the Shining Path Maoist guerrilla movement as an example of terrorism, they dismantled the Constitution, they set up military tribunals, secret ones in order to carry on secret trials. That's how Lori Behrens for the U.S. activists got jailed there, and they did many other things in terms of how they dismantled what civil liberties there were in response to this. And provocateur actions are classic within any state strategy, especially in the modern world, where you set up an action that provokes a response by the state. I mean, it was the Chicago police riots in 1968. Against the demonstrators there, eventually came out that the people that burned the flags or threw the bags of feces at the cop cars were in fact Office of Naval Intelligence operatives that had been hired to do so and posing as protesters. So I gave numerous examples in the talk, but the other thing I was pointing out was that with the Soviet Union and the threat of communism no longer useful as a propaganda ploy, they had to find some enemy, and that the enemy would be domestic terrorism. And I based this on studies of RAND Corporation and many of these big think tanks and the security agencies that were being beefed up at the time in order to develop scenarios for response going all the way to martial law to any kind of domestic terrorism. And there were stages going from conventional weapons to chemical and biological, all the way up to nuclear, and how the system would respond. Once the system goes into an emergency or a war situation, and certainly it went into an emergency on 9/11, whole sets of legal changes happen. Now, up to 500 legal authorities shift over once you formally declare at the presidential level a national emergency and carry it out. They don't all have to be changed, but it's possible to change them. And it basically consolidates government power within a few agencies and a few people within the broad base of elected so-called representatives. I come from D.C., where we are a colony still, and we have taxation without representation. That's what our license plate says, in fact, and we did that so that Bush would have to put one on his car. And we have a non-voting elected representative in Congress. The difference for the rest of you is that you have elected people that have a vote, but they don't represent you either. And so we're just a step further toward being honest about it, in that we're not even given the vote. But the response on September 11th was to go to that kind of a consolidation, and a continuity of government situation was declared, which meant that power rested then with a few people in the administration and a few leaders in Congress, and essentially shifted over to the Pentagon, the DOD, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and the National Security Agency. And I would argue that effectively since September 11, 2001, we have continued in that continuity of government model. There was even a banner headline on the Washington Post some months ago that said, "Shadow Government Operating in Secret." And when I saw the headline, I thought, gee, maybe I could get a job finally writing at the Post. But here they were putting it out in the open that the middle management and Cheney sitting down in this bunker at an undisclosed location, which means Bluemont, Virginia, where they have this little Pentagon, as my mother used to call it, sunk 2 miles into the mountainside there. They had actually closed the facility down. A friend of mine who's a freelance journalist got in to see it. The computers were all out of date, but they opened it back up, and now they use it as Cheney's little hidey hole, where he goes when there's an emergency, while Bush sits up with the rest of us. We had a peach code alert on September 10th this year. I don't know if you heard about it. It wasn't quite yellow and it wasn't quite orange, so they said it was peach. And they said that there was an imminent threat of attack, another terrorist attack, and that we had to be wary and we had to be vigilant. Well, I was having a candlelight vigil that night, and I've always been wary of the government, so I thought I was following orders. But I watched as this scene unfolded, and one of the things they said was that all the same signs that happened before September 11th were being seen again, and that's why this attack was so imminent. But I thought that they said they didn't have any signs before September 11th, so they were now seeing the signs that they had missed before or something, but anyway, it was imminent. And so then they had an exercise where they put all these planes in the air over D.C., unlike September 11, 2001, when we didn't have a single plane up. We had all these military planes flying over and the helicopters and everything, and the general was on CNN, and then they had moved a missile battery launcher out in front of the Pentagon to defend it, and only it didn't have any missiles in it. And then the general mentioned that the planes were not armed, and even the CNN dummy got it. And he said, like, well, what if something happens? And the general said, well, if something happened, we'd go back and put the weapons on the plane. So we were well defended, as usual. And, we had our little alert. But during that time, Cheney canceled his talks and went down in the hole, and Bush stayed up with us, which should tell you something. I used to tell Mae Brussel, who was a mentor of mine in doing this research, and a woman who was indefatigable in terms of the amount of work that she did. She clipped 15 daily newspapers. I've only gotten up to 2 back when newspapers had enough content to make them worth clipping. I used to do that. I no longer do it. But I said to her at one point before she died in the late 80s that knowing what we knew and knowing the cast of characters and the interrelations, and the fact that they were doing more and more to hide themselves in terms of the news control and the news propaganda, that it would probably be useful to go to November 22nd, 1963 and clip backwards, because they wouldn't be covering their tracks as well, and we could probably find out more knowing what we knew of the structure in its history. And so I've used that principle with 9/11, and I went backwards to take a look at what preceded things in the news leading up to that day. And of course, we had been working for some time to try to get files released from the government. The Freedom of Information Act was essentially useless. But when Ashcroft came into office, he specifically said after 9/11 that any government agency who is being sued in court for Freedom of Information Act release, who doesn't want to release their documents, will have the full weight of the Justice Department supporting their right to keep the documents secret. So we've entered into a time of, if it could be, increased secrecy. And essentially our history has been put down into a hole, controlled and commodified by the national security state. We don't own the history. The national security state owns our history. And we can only find out about it 30, 40 years later if we fight for it and if we're lucky. And the situation, I think, has really, in many ways, deteriorated since September 11th in terms of what options that we have. But I think one thing that was significant was that in the late 80s and up in through the 90s, there were attempts to take a look at by the corporations, the multinational corporations, look at the resources all over the world and figure out mechanisms and positioning of powers in order to do this sort of what Buckminster Fuller called in his last book, GRUNCH, Gross Universal Cash Heist, and to try to make the final bid for the resources and materials around the world. And if that meant destabilizing situations or doing other things that you know, were harmful to people in those countries, that wasn't the issue. The issue was how could we establish dominance there, and eventually now what's being talked about is total global dominance. And this, the debate that I think is really raging is not so much over Iraq per se, although that's its details at the moment, but it was fleshed out in August 21st, 2001, about a little less than a month before September 11th on the front page of the Washington Post. And it was a debate between the circle around Bush and what are called neocons or neoconservatives, and actually then at that time elements of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And the argument was based on some writings by a guy at a right-wing think tank who said, America is an empire, and we ought to admit we're an empire, and we ought to go about being an empire, and we ought to establish Pax Americana, and we have the strength, and we should just set ourselves up and go out there and do it. And the hell with the rest of the world. And the Pentagon was saying, we have enough to do as it is. So that was talked about more openly than it's being now as really the framework of the debate. And after 9/11, the incident was used in many ways, I feel, to make that alignment to the extent that we could force it between the global corporations and their agenda, the what's called the neoliberal model countries, where they've established through the IMF and the World Bank these models of structural adjustment and economic control from outside, and the existing powers, as well as the wannabes. China, for example, jumped into the World Trade Organization on September the 12th. And Russia was the first country to call and offer assistance to Bush after the September 11th incident. And while they have minor disagreements, I believe that that's basically the axis that formed after September 11th on one side of the world, and then what remains are these underdeveloped countries and the few pockets of resistance that still remain within the neoliberal countries, or more importantly, here at home. because I would argue that we are in essentially the same position as the German people were in September of 1939. Poland has been invaded, a world war has been declared, and a Holocaust of unimaginable proportions now is looming. But unlike Hitler, Bush has no external enemies. And it was up to the German people in September 39. Unfortunately, they didn't do what they should have done. But I think similarly, it's up to people here in the United States, because I think we are the final last bulwark against this turn. I believe it's really a crossroad in human history, this turn toward the nightmare path of permanent warfare and total global dominance that these elements want to carry out, which will be genocidal, and the other potential path, because we are beyond scarcity in human history, we are at a point of objective surplus. There is enough arable land in the world and water still to feed and take care of people's basic needs. Overpopulation is not so great in any country that if land was used for food, it couldn't feed the people. And although some resources are scarce, there are ways to stop the trend towards scarcity. There's also ways to go to alternative energy at this point and alternative types of economies. And for everybody to be housed and clothed and fed, entertained, transported, and interneted all around the world, if that was what we wanted to use the resources for. And the technology, it exists, and with less labor. So I really think that's the point we're at, whether human history is going to go toward, and with less damage to the planet, without ravaging the planet. It's either going to go that way, or it's going to go toward a level of destruction that's, the Nazi Hohenzollern machine looks like a rubber band affair compared to what this machinery can do. And not only the nuclear, but the near nuclear and everything else. But tracking backwards, it was evident that the oil in the Caspian Sea basin was of great interest, because the oil industry was basically predicting that the Saudi oil by 2025 would be essentially exhausted at current use levels, and that would, at that point, the Caspian Sea oil up in what used to be the USSR would be about 80% of the remaining known oil reserve. And so Brzezinski was very focused on this in the Carter years, and he wrote about it in a book where he said the pivotal point where we'd need to put military troops in order to control that would be in Uzbekistan. And you may have noticed that the military aid to Uzbekistan is now tripled, and that bases are being inserted there by the U.S., and in fact, they're being inserted by Halliburton, Cheney's old company, who have this package deal they're contracted out to do what they call base in a box. And it's a privatized version of a military base. The corporation flies over the infrastructure of the base with armed civilians. They build the base, and then when they're done, they move the troops into it. But they secure it and set it up at first, and they get a pretty dollar to do that. So basically, it's instant base wherever they want it, but we're positioning ourselves there. And there was a plan by a corporation called Unocal to build a pipeline down to the sea. Now, the reason they want a pipeline to the sea is that if you can get the oil onto a tanker, then the tanker goes out to sea and the ports must bid for where it will bring the oil. And that bidding artificially inflates the price of the oil. Except for those that actually control the pipeline. And the point of that is not even so much that we use a disproportionate amount of oil and need more oil if we remain addicted to it, but it's also that we have not wanted Japan and Germany, our main competitors in the capitalist world, to get their hands on these vast oil deposits or cheap oil anywhere. And so part of the reason for the first Gulf War was also to make sure that Kuwait remained as a blockage from the oil in Iraq getting down to the sea or becoming accessible on the international market. It was one of the ways that we militarily strangled Japan and Germany, and in fact it was a boycott of oil in Japan, arguably, prior to Pearl Harbor that provoked that. Because neither have an internal oil source. And that's how I believe they were dragged then in the 70s by the Rockefellers into the Trilateral Commission axis of Japan, Germany, and the United States was because of this oil shortage. The other total irony is that we're about 4% of the world population using close to 60% of the oil and other non-renewable energy sources in the world. Out of that uneven part of the pie, though, according to the trade magazines in the mid-80s, 60%, and arguably by now, upwards of 80% of that would be for military use. General Schwarzkopf spoke at Texas A&M University and said that, and it was a 10-year anniversary of the Gulf War. He was with Bush and Fitzwater and Powell, and they were celebrating their great victory. And Schwarzkopf got up and started ticking off how many aircraft carriers it took and how many planes and how many troops and this and that. And then he mentioned how much oil. It was 3.5 billion gallons of oil to fight the first Gulf War. Well, that's more oil than they could have easily gotten out of Kuwait. So that irony is that we're fighting wars in order to have control of enough oil to be able to fight the wars. And, you know, that hasn't really been fully explored yet. But Unocal came in and was making an assessment of a pipeline through Afghanistan down to the sea, and the Northern Alliance was going along with it, but the Taliban was balking. And so in 99, their head of foreign relations at Unocal testified to the Foreign Affairs Subcommittee in the Congress that the Taliban was basically standing between us and 80% of the world's oil in 15 or 20 years and had to be removed. But because there was no immediate action on the plan, Unocal said that they had abandoned their idea. And then a second pipeline cutting across the Northern Alliance and Northern Afghanistan, but then going into Pakistan and down to the sea, was being explored and proposed by another company named Enron. And so it may be that what happened with Enron is part of an oil war over these pipelines. But in any case, Unocal's back in. The president of the new Afghanistan was closely linked with Unocal as a consultant. The ambassador to the United States from the new Afghanistan was a Unocal employee. And the other moderate leaders of the Northern Alliance were the, if you go back to the New York Times, 5 years, you'll see that these were the major opium dealers in the country. And now the country has restored itself to being, again, 80% of the world opium source comes out of Afghanistan. So at least those things have been restored, which is what matters to the people that that fight the wars or make the plans, regardless of anything to do with freeing Afghanis or worrying about Afghani women. I mean, it's really terribly hypocritical for the Bushes and these people to be saying that they're, you know, doing these things to liberate people when there was a secular government in Afghanistan before William Casey and Brzezinski initially, and then the others later came in and through covert operations and funding established these reactionary fundamentalist Islamic mullahs to take over and do a coup against that government. And the women had positions in the society, so they had a secular and relatively open democratic society before the U.S. intervened. Then when there was a counter coup by the more secular forces, they appealed to the Soviet Union to come in and defend them. The U.S. kept funding the counter-reaction from the reactionary mullahs and did so consciously, we now know from Brzezinski's writings and statements, because they wanted to get the Soviet Union involved in a quagmire like Vietnam that would drain them and eventually help to unseat them and ruin the USSR. And so, of course, it was a tremendous cost, as the Vietnam War was to this society, to put their resources into trying to defend against this massive influx of mujahideen who were being recruited and trained through CIA funds. Now, the cover for those funds was Pakistani ISI intelligence, but it was really a Casey operation, which is significant when we get into the details of 9-1-1. But it ran through several administrations, and it brought people from all over the world. It gave them weapons. It trained them. I mean, recently when I saw a picture that the U.S. was blowing up this weapons cache in Afghanistan, and the local people were arguing that these were not Al-Qaeda weapons in this cave, but belonged to the local people, and they had kept them in case they could ever get back into a position in government or, you know, to restore themselves. And they were arguing with the U.S. about, were these Al-Qaeda weapons or not? My response was, does it say made in the USA on them? Because that would tell you. I mean, they don't have these Stinger missiles or all of this armament without us. Even the caves themselves that we were bombing into were built by NATO for these Mujahideen fighters when they were opposing our enemies. Then they were freedom fighters, but now they have a different opprobrium linked to them. Although I don't think the blowback analysis, which is what most of the left has of this situation, blowback being an unintended consequence of a covert operation, is the way to understand what happened on September 11th. I don't think these forces were first trained and armed by us and then went completely out of our control. And I'll give you some specific examples why. But I think that you know, and then it was also interesting to me because they said they wanted to deny them to the Al-Qaeda. Well, if you want to deny the weapons, why aren't you loading them onto a truck and moving them? Why are you blowing them up? Well, you blow them up because then you have to sell them again to replace them. So in terms of the munitions industry, I mean, weapons are a great boon to any investment scheme because you only use them once. And so they get to have them paid for twice if they blow them up, plus use up some explosive as well. And I was awakened that morning by a call from one of the Kennedy researchers on September 11th, 2001, telling me that the first tower had been hit. He works with air traffic around the Dulles area on a county-wide board that has to do with making planning for the airport and, you know, airport matters and the industry. So he knew right away that there should never have been any sort of a commercial plane anywhere near those towers, that this would have been way off flight course and that it made no sense. And as we were discussing that, the second plane hit. And then I remember he said to me, well, the balloon is up. And so I thought the more important point was not what did they know and when did they know it beforehand, although they could have known, but by 9:05, when the second tower has been hit, 9:03 to 9:05, everyone in the country knows that accident theory and coincidence theory are out the window. And then you have a period that goes, by some accounts, till 9:43, by my clock, 9:47, when I heard the explosion and it shook my windows in my house. And by 8:25, NORAD knew that four planes had been hijacked, which was almost entirely unprecedented. Certainly four within the United States, it was unprecedented. So they had a lot of lead time knowledge to respond. And I was watching the local news because I went downstairs, turned on CNN and also Channel 8, and Channel 8 announced that two planes were turning around and coming back to D.C. Well, if I knew they were coming to D.C., I mean, don't you think they knew? I mean, how could I know? I mean, how could the local news know it and the people at the top not know what was happening? So they had at least 40, maybe 45 minutes to respond to that situation. And where I live is the most restricted airspace in the country. It's called P-56, and they have an outer and inner layer of this airspace. So I have, growing up in D.C., seen planes go up to challenge on just a normal day, no crisis, no emergency, but a commercial aircraft or a small plane that gets off course and starts to come into P-56 is picked up immediately on Pentagon and other radar that they have specifically the military run there, and they're intercepted and they're wagged out of the area. And so there's an immediate response. And the FAA and NORAD have regulations for immediate response to any plane that goes off course significantly for even a few minutes or a few degrees, that cuts off communication with a tower or loses communication, or turns off its transponder, which identifies it easily to the towers. It doesn't mean it can't be seen on the radar, but it's not as brightly reflected, and it's not immediately identified. It's an ID tag. So if any of those things happen, FAA notices, NORAD gets called immediately, and within 3 to 6 minutes, they have something up the closest planes to go and take a look at it and find out, because the pilot could be dead or it's endangering other planes if it's not flying on course. Also, most flight, even in from well-trained pilots, is done from tower to tower. It's hard to get down through cloud cover. It's hard to land, even on a bright day, without assistance. And basically, a tower will take a plane out to the point where the next tower intersects, and they'll pass them off, and they'll watch their flight path and tell them, you know, you have to adjust this or go up or down. And so it's a guided flight. And so they're immediately aware anyway. One of the first questions I had was, if you hijacked a plane and you took it out into the middle of Ohio, Pennsylvania, and then you turned the transponder off and you stopped communicating with the towers, how do you know how to turn that plane around and aim it at, much less a city, at a particular building? How do you know how to guide that plane without any kind of external assistance? And I think that's a question that really hasn't been answered. Also, these planes were flown in a way that indicated to me, and to anybody who's been a pilot on planes that size, that whoever was flying them had to be either a very experienced military or civilian pilot, because these planes were doing things that were like a dogfight maneuver, both in New York and especially in D.C. They were maneuvers that the trainers down in the Florida schools, where some of these people had supposedly gotten training on a simulator, they said it was a simulator for a different plane, but if those things had been done on the simulator would have shut off, because it would have indicated the plane was going out of control, or at least potentially. So it had to be somebody that really knew how to fly a plane to go, as they did in D.C., from 5,000 feet or, down, making a 270-degree loop around the Pentagon in order to hit the far side of the Pentagon as they're coming down, and flying for a period, knocking off the lampposts, flying very low and coming in that way. Is not something that an inexperienced pilot is going to be able to do. They're going to lose control of the plane. And yet, even though all these procedures are in place, and there are many instances, I think somebody just quoted me 67 instances in the last few years where these kind of intercepts happen. And an intercept doesn't mean they shoot the plane down. It means they go up and engage with the plane and try to make sure that the pilots, you know, try to get local communication with it, and they can shoot across its bow or move in front of it or wag at it to tell it to come down or move the way they're indicating. But none of that was done, and apparently nothing was scrambled. And in the first week, the Pentagon said, well, we have no mechanism. And I said, you have no mechanism? I mean, if they have no mechanism, the first thing I thought was, what did you do with the $13 trillion that you took since the end of World War II? I mean, there's got to be a subliminal message somewhere here that the Pentagon can't defend itself, so how's it going to defend the rest of us? I mean, isn't that in there someplace? If you take this as the official story, I know they have a mechanism because I sat on one of them, because I grew up in the Pentagon. My father, my mother, my aunt were Pentagon employees, and as a kid, I was taken in that building all the time. And we used to eat lunch often in the courtyard. And when I was about 12 years old, I sat down on a metal box. And my dad said, get the hell off of that. And I said, what is it, Dad? And he said, it's a surface-to-air missile port. This is the 1950s, okay, or early 60s. I mean, they had them then. I mean, and so I know they have mechanisms. In fact, it's not the Pentagon that doesn't have a mechanism to defend itself. It's the American people. But the Pentagon not only has those mechanisms, they have more. They have planes at Andrews Air Force Base, which is about 10 miles away. They have fighter planes at Anacostia Naval Air Station. Both of these are specifically assigned, the Air National Guard and the military planes, to guard D.C. That's their job, and they're on combat ready, and, you know, they're down there. So they have the planes. Anacostia is even closer, just right across the river from the building. And some of the Andrews planes fly over my house and the helicopters, you know, on a regular basis as they're going out into Maryland. So they have, you know, as you might imagine, around D.C., they have military planes. And even if you don't have a plane on total scramble ready and somebody sitting ready to jump into it or sitting in the cockpit already, it doesn't mean that you can't get a plane up in a few minutes. I mean, you might not get up in 3 to 5 minutes. Maybe you'll get it up in 7 to 10 minutes. But if you can't get a plane up for 35 to 40 minutes, you don't have a defense anyway. And so the idea that it was defenseless. But then in 1998, I was involved in a demonstration at the Pentagon. I organized a demonstration called A Day Without the Pentagon. And I wasn't meaning that I should run a plane into it and make it blow up. I meant what would happen if we didn't have a Pentagon to fund for one day. How much would just that one day at $8,000 a second mean in terms of social funding for the United States? So it was the first big demonstration there since the 70s. And so they made a big to-do out of it and brought out all this security and everything. But I had a meeting with the head of the Pentagon security, and he took me into the building for a tour. And he took me for a tour that my mother never took me on, into the areas around the actual offices of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and past the place where they eat lunch. And then he walked me out into the area beyond that section outside the building, which is where our march was going to end up in this parade ground. And he said, "You can't come up beyond this wall here because, that's as far as you can come." And I said, "Well, there was a Supreme Court," and it was beyond the parking lot. And I said, "Well, there's a Supreme Court decision in the 70s that says that we can come all the way up the steps." And he said, "Not now." And I said, "Well, why?" And he said, "We're on Delta alert." And I said, "What's Delta alert?" He said, "It's our highest form of security alert. In other words, it goes from Alpha, Beta, Charlie, Delta. And they're going up, and so they're on their highest form of alert in 1998. I said, "Why are you on your highest form of alert? What's happening?" He said, "Oh, we get bomb threats every day from Muslims." Then he pointed up to the roof of the building, and he said, "And we have radar up there on the roof in case they try to run a plane into the building." And then he said that they also have cameras up there that watch the skies, and he said that they would be pointing them at us and taping our demonstration. And I said, "Good, can we get a copy?" He's never offered to send me one. I suppose it would be compromising a source or a method. Did they turn it off? I mean, of course they have radar on top of the building. Of course they know. And could they have known that somebody would run a plane into a building? Was this something so totally outside the box? No one ever thought of this. You know, what an amazing idea. No, I mean, they knew not only that somebody could, they knew that Al-Qaeda had used a plane to attack a building in Moscow. They had foiled a plot in Paris to run a plane into the Eiffel Tower. They were so worried about a plane hitting Bush at the economic summit in Genoa that they made all the planes stand down that day and move Bush to a secreted location, not the one they announced where he was, and made sure that no planes were flying anywhere close to where the summit was. So this idea that they're caught completely with their pants down, no mechanism, and all this is nonsense. Then, in order to try to explain it, and I believe they're very vulnerable in this, and the press is not going after them on this point at all, but they opened up the war room to the press. For the first time in history, they let CNN into the war room on the September 11 anniversary. So this was the public relations ploy, you know, we're going to let you into the inner sanctum, the sanctum sanctorum, and therefore we're going to give you the secrets and tell you the truth. And then they had the guy that says he was in charge of the war room on September 11th. And this is a general named Winthrop Montague, who's African-American. Now, I'm sorry, but I don't think Winthrop Montague is the guy that normally runs operations at the war room of the United States and the Pentagon. I think this guy was chumped to be in there that day. And he says, and this is supposed to explain it, he says, we didn't respond right away because the FAA was tracking seemingly unrelated hijackings. Does that mean that when one hijacking happens, you have to wait for a second one, and then it has to be related before you can respond to it? What does that mean? seemingly unrelated hijackings. I mean, after all, you haven't had a hijacking in years. Now you've got four on the same day out of two airports. Somebody might think they're related, but maybe it's like the Washington Post when they found acoustical evidence of a shot from the front of Kennedy that said that maybe it was another lone nut who had showed up at the same time. And besides that, they said there was no evidence that they knew each other. Who knew each other? So there were these seemingly unrelated hijackings that day, so they weren't responding, you know. I mean, a hijacking is a hijacking. You respond, whether it's related or not. Maybe it was four totally unrelated incidents. That means you sit there and watch it and try to figure out whether it's related. What does it mean? It means it's nonsensical, these things that they're saying. Not only that, I found out later that on that day, after the first towers were hit in New York, the two towers were hit, the Pentagon went from no alert to an alpha alert, their lowest level of alert. And then after the Pentagon itself was hit, they went to a Charlie, not to a Delta. I mean, they're on a Delta when they're getting phone calls, and when the building smashed into, they're on a Charlie. What does that mean? To me, it was like November 22nd when they take the crypto books out of the Strategic Air Command bomber pilot planes that are in the air, and nobody is capable of a response. They did have a shoot-down order that Cheney and Bush agreed about. Both have talked about it. Within moments after the 905, as soon as they hit communication, they agreed to give a shoot-down order. But the pilots that are being interviewed on the few planes that did go up and were scrambled say that they were never given a shoot-down order and that they're glad they weren't. So there's some disconnect there, too, who failed to relay to the pilots that there was a shoot-down order on these planes. And Cheney, in the Woodward article in the Post, says that he was giving it repeatedly. But that again, I mean, these patterns in my research return when you go into these incidents. There's things that don't fit normal operating procedures, and there's blockages in terms of what the normal communication or other things would be. Now, Bush tells us on 60 Minutes at the anniversary that he went up in Air Force One, and he was apprised of this supposed plot, and it's been later denied and then renewed again, so we don't know whether this is real or not or what it is. It seems like an inside job to me. But that the code name of the plane, because they have a Secret Service code name for Air Force One, had been revealed somehow, that they got an external communication mentioning the code name of the plane, and so the plane was endangered. And they relayed that danger to Bush, and so he says. Then he's talking to Cheney from the plane on their secure communications. And the secure communications in the plane go off. And Bush is whacking the phone, he said, on the table. And they're forced to call on insecured cell phones from Air Force One. Now, don't you think they have a redundancy system for those communications? I mean, that's the president communicating to the whole spectrum. I mean, it just shuts off, and it shuts off for a long period. I mean, he's up there in the air, he goes down, he lands, he goes back up, he's still out of communication. He's out of the loop. He says he gets concerned because the American people are not going to know what he wants, and you know, he's not going to be seen as separate. And so he's arguing to come back to D.C. He forces the plane to land, and he does an exclusive interview with Fox News. He goes back up in the plane. But before he lands, and after he's given this initial warning that the plane's been compromised, they see a plane nearby coming in their direction, and so they take evasive action. So there's a second threat there. There's actually a third threat that morning at the hotel where he's staying out, which is usually not public knowledge where he's actually staying. Four Arabs show up in a van at 6 in the morning and tell the hotel people that they have an appointment to see Bush. Four Arab men, and then the Secret Service supposedly shoo them away, but they didn't pay attention to who they were. Supposedly they don't know their identities. This cutoff of communications happened November 22nd, 63. The secure lines between the federal agencies and departments, which were known as Federal Exchange Lines or FedEx lines, not the company FedEx, but that's what they were called, not the Bell telephones, but the secure lines so that they could communicate with each other, secretly and without public compromise of the information between State Department, DOD, and all that, went dead, according to my mother, at the Pentagon at the hour of the Kennedy assassination, and were down for a period of 2 hours. Another thing that happened on November 22nd, if you remember, and also happened March 31, 81 with Reagan, is that the black box, the nuclear football, the command and control unit that's supposed to be with the president 24/7, disappears. The black box does not leave Dallas on Air Force One with Johnson. And Johnson doesn't get it until much later that evening. So that, again, is taking this command control away from the people that should have it, or according to the plotters, in my view, should not have it, in the same way that compromising the cryptology on the planes makes it impossible for them to respond, or for somebody to start a war with the Soviet Union, because Oswald, the patsy, has been dipped as a red and said to be a defector, and so somebody outside the loop may say, well, my God, you know, the commies did it, and start World War III, and so you disarm. And similarly, on March 31, 81, this guy Gonzalez, you can see him in the footage, he's carrying the black box. He drops to the ground when the shooting starts and hugs it, gets up when the shooting's over, and runs away from Reagan. And he doesn't come back for hours later. He comes back with a Secret Service guy to talk to the FBI, because the FBI has gotten the clothes from the nurses that are stripped off of Reagan's body. They've taken the wallet out. It's got the command card, the same as you have an ATM card. Well, the president has a little activating card that he sticks into the football to say it's him and to start it going. It's also in some of the other written articles about Haig, who, if you remember, emerged from the Situation Room where they were fighting, saying, gentlemen, I'm in charge here until the vice president returns. Haig was desperately trying to get a command box working, a black box working there in the Pentagon, or I'm sorry, in the White House Situation Room, and he couldn't. But they came after and tried to get this card, and the FBI guy had the presence of mind to say, well, wait a minute, I better ask the boss. So he calls headquarters, and headquarters says, Sessions not here, he's down in the Situation Room. And he calls Sessions, and Sessions says, hang on to the card. So when you're having these transitions of power, these go. And then the Commerce Club, about 3 weeks ago now, out in San Francisco, in a public talk, Cheney said, I have the black box. That should tell you something. Cheney has the black box, not Bush. Okay? That there are transitions in terms of what happened that day and what continues to happen. And here's Bush up out of the loop. He's taken to all these different bases. Finally, the Secret Service required him to sign a waiver relieving them of the responsibility to protect his life so that he could then come back to D.C. And on the 60 Minutes, Cheney is openly quoted saying, I didn't think, and Condoleezza Rice didn't think, he should come back. We decided it wasn't safe for him to come back. So, but the effect is he's kept out of the loop, and Cheney, Condoleezza Rice in the White House Situation Room, Powell's out of the country in Peru. Tenet, the CIA director, is having breakfast that morning with Senator Howard Baker, I think it was. And but in the Pentagon war room, there's Rumsfeld, and then Montague, I guess. And then there's also Cheney and Condoleezza Rice down in the down the basement of the White House, and Bush out in the middle of nowhere, being shipped from base to base, and got out as far as Nebraska before he came back. I was making this analysis and these arguments very early on, about a week afterwards, to a Pentagon freelance correspondent in D.C. at a party that I met, and he told me he was reporting the Pentagon. I said, why didn't some planes come up to respond to this plane? They had plenty of time. They knew it was coming. He said, oh, didn't you read in the New York Times, and I can't find the site, so maybe you read it somewhere else, but he said, didn't you read in the New York Times that half of the scramble-ready planes in the United States were taken offline 3 days before the incident? I said, no, I didn't. I said, are you making your argument or mine? I mean, why would half of the planes be taken off of scramble-ready 3 days before? You know, that's a benign explanation. I mean, to me, it's worth asking about. Now, Bill Kelly, another researcher that I work with, has been doing some work interviewing pilots at Pomona Air Base outside of Atlantic City. It's about halfway between D.C. and Atlantic City, and a place where they could scramble planes from. And they told him initially that 2 weeks before the incident, they had been on a ready status and were taken down off of it. This was 2 weeks before September 11th. Then he talked to them further, and because they had said, well, we didn't have the weapons aboard, and it took us half an hour to load them, and so he thought that that was dead time, you know, that they were trying to get up in the air and couldn't. Then he got the real story from one of the pilots. Somebody introduced him to a pilot that went up that day. And those pilots were up in the air. They not responding to 9/11, they were just up in the air because they have regular exercises where they leave Atlantic City, they fly into New York, they load a weapon onto the plane, and they fly it back over pre-designated targets as a sort of simulated target run. And these are exercises they do regularly, Air National Guard out of Pomona, 177th Air Wing. So these guys tell them the story. 9:05, they're sitting on the tarmac, and they go up. They're up between, they're there earlier. They're up between the first hit and the second hit, between 8:43 and 9:05. They're in the air heading toward New York. So presumably they could have been called into duty to respond to the second plane. They're on the way. They're not that far. These planes go 1,600 miles an hour, you know, if they want to. So they could have called them, but these guys said for the first time in their career doing these runs, or at all, they were called back to base. They were told there was an emergency, and they were told to come back to base. So they're called back, and they assume, not being told anything, that somebody in their family had died. And the two pilots came back and landed when they were in a position to respond. Now, a little later, after the no mechanism story didn't float so well, somebody started to say, well, there were planes that went up. There was planes from Otis Air Force Base out in Connecticut, and of course they have planes much closer to New York, were scrambled, and also planes were scrambled out of Langley, which is 130 miles to the south of D.C., but in both cases they got there too late. Now, when you take the time, that, official time that they supposedly were scrambled and left, and take the distance that they would have flown, they're flying way below their possible speeds. I mean, they're flying 600-700 miles an hour, not 1,600 mph. They're not on afterburners. Although two of the pilots out of Connecticut claimed they were flying with afterburners, so that has to mean that they left earlier because they were still 8 minutes outside of New York, according to the official report, at the time the second towers hit. So there's something wrong with the timing and the speeds and when they were actually sent up. But even more telling, in a book called Among the Heroes, there's a pilot who's interviewed out of Langley, and he says they were scrambled, but they weren't scrambled to come to D.C. They were scrambled to go to New York. And on the way to New York, they were asked to look out the window and verify that the Pentagon had been hit. So they're not, I mean, they're the closest thing, you know, that they can conjure around D.C., but then they're sending them to New York out of Virginia and doing nothing about Flight 77. Now, there is a rumor, maybe you picked up on the emails and stuff, that the plane, Flight 77, did not hit the Pentagon. And I want to assure you that that is a rumor. If you lived in D.C., even though there was no footage that's been released, I'm sure the Pentagon got footage, but there was no commercial footage released. But there were plenty of eyewitnesses, and I've talked to many people who saw the plane go into the building. And in addition to that, when I heard what flight it was, Flight 77 out of Dulles LAX, my heart stopped because a good friend of all of ours in the research community, T. Carter, is an airline attendant on that plane on a regular run. That's the plane that she most often flies, so I thought T. had died that day. And luckily, she was home taking care of her dad, who was sick. But she was taken into the wreckage, and she recognized the pieces of plane that she had flown on, and then she was shown pictures of the dead crew members and a severed arm with a bracelet on it that she could identify as her best friend's bracelet. So Flight 77 did go into the Pentagon. Did something else go into it? I can't tell you. People say, why didn't it make a bigger hole? Because look at the wings, the wingspan is wider than the hole. Well, T's immediate response to that is, do you know what's in the wings? The fuel. So as soon as you have the contact, the wings are going to disintegrate, you know, in the explosion of the fuel, and they're not going to drive through the walls of the building. The body of the plane did that, and compromised it, but it definitely went into the building. But they had plenty of time to respond from a number of different locations, including a surface-to-air missile at the White House that they put in after this little Piper plane came down, again without radar interference, or interception, and flew into the front of the White House. It actually hit a tree before it actually hit the White House, but it was headed toward the Clintons' bedroom. I don't know if you remember this. And there was a guy in it. And then that morning I woke up and they said, a plane has flown into the front of the White House and the pilot's dead and we don't know who he is and we don't know what it's about. But don't worry, the Clintons are safe because they were doing repairs and they're not there, they're over at the Blair House. And I said, well, I'm glad they're no real terrorists. Because you just told them you missed him. And they don't know if there's backup, they don't know if there's a second plane. And here this plane is flown by this veteran who's on 100% psychiatric disability at a VA ward that lives on the VA ward. And yet in the Baltimore Sun, his son is quoted saying, my dad had keys to lots of planes. Put those two things together. I can't. And then he steals a plane out of this airport in Baltimore, and there's no alarm. I mean, what is it? There goes another one. Harry, who you think's in it? You know, I mean, what's that? He steals this plane, then he comes down in there, and the first thing was, oh, we didn't get him on the radar because he was below tree level, flying along the mall. Well, he was up above tree level most of the flight. Secondly, they said, oh, we looked later and he was on the radar, but that was between 2 and 3 in the morning, and we don't look at the radar during those hours. We have other duties. And again, I said, I'm glad there's no real terrorists, because you've told them when to come. But I mean, that plane was allowed in just in the same way that Flight 77 was allowed to come in to DC, and it was a military stand-down. It's also important that this plane, the Pentagon lies out in an open area. There's nothing on any side of it. So if you were in a military mission to do some damage to the building, I would think, since you don't know that they're not going to fire their surface-to-air missile, or whatever they have to defend themselves, wouldn't you go toward the nearest wall and make the impact as quickly as you could? But instead, this plane flies 270 degrees around the building to one of the farthest walls and goes in there, and it just happens to be the wall of the side of the building that they've been rebuilding for the last 5 years, very visibly. And anybody who looked ahead of time would know, and those offices were empty. So about 185 people had died, 160. Four of them were people either in the plane or in the construction crews outside that died in the explosion. Only 15 to 20 people died inside the Pentagon because most of the offices were empty. And I would argue that this is a very sophisticated operation, covert operation, and that even in New York, they also minimized the number of deaths. Hard to say when you have 2,000 to 3,000 people, but that plane coming in there at 8:43 is at a time before most people were at work. If you think of it coming in at 9:43, you're going to have tens of thousands of deaths. And so if you're really external terrorists wanting to do the big impact and hurt as many people as possible, why would you pick these locations and this timing that would minimize the number? And I don't think we yet know really what happened on those flights or who was responsible. Seven of the people named and pictured, it turns out, were using fake ID that belonged to people that are still living in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and who said, that's my picture, that's my name, but I wasn't on the plane because I live here, I wasn't in the United States. The first evidence link to this crew that's supposedly the mastermind, Mohammed Atta and these others, the first evidence link was a car, if you remember, that was parked in the parking lot at Logan Airport, that they then said had been rented from these guys that came down through Canada. They had some passport trail on them. They had rented a car outside of Boston and then driven it to Logan Airport and left it in the parking lot. The way they found this car was, this is the supposed story, a guy led them to it, and he called them after the incident, hearing that a plane out of Logan had gone into one of the New York buildings. And he called them because he said that morning four Arab men had been vying for a parking space with him and had gotten out of the car and had a road rage argument with him over a parking space. Now, I would argue that on their way to a long-planned secret operation, at least from their side, that this is an untenable story, that they would have a road. I mean, they're already going to be pegged as Arabs. Do they want to be pegged as angry Arabs? And this, to me, seems like, I doubt the incident happened. I think whoever led them to the car is actually a shill, and that it was a story so they could go to the evidence, because that car, inside of it, had a Koran, and it had a copy of a manual, supposedly a flight manual, for that plane written in Arabic. Well, why would you be cramming for the last 5 minutes and then leave it in the car? Why wouldn't you bring it aboard the plane? It's not like somebody's going to read Farsi and figure out, hey, that's a manual, fly this plane. I mean, these, you know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of the bundle outside of Kniep's amusement, dropped 5 minutes before King is shot, that contains the rifle, the belongings. It's planted evidence. And when you do a covert operation, you spend more time on the cover story than you do on the operation itself. And part of that is going to be false sponsorship. So even if all these people are part of Al-Qaeda, and even if the story is essentially secure, how it happened, and even if they're all related to Osama bin Laden, that still doesn't tell me who sponsored this event, because bin Laden works for Pakistani intelligence, Saudi intelligence, U.S. intelligence. He's in Paris, he's in Kosovo, he's in Chechnya. He's all over the map. And he's working for all different kinds of factions, in the same way that this guy Abu Nidal, who just either suicided or was shot, they don't say which, who was supposedly the great nemesis of Oliver North, and he said he built this security fence around his house to protect himself from this terrorist, Abu Nidal. Well, it came out also in the papers and in the testimony that Oliver North's company, through Adnan Khashoggi, was supplying arms to Abu Nidal and selling him arms. So I used to call him Abu Giman. And, you know, I think that a lot of these terrorists in the world are really created by the agency, and quite often you'll have these groups, you only hear their name once, you never hear it again. They take credit for something like this bombing of the barracks in Lebanon, and then the CIA, it comes out a few weeks later, had been involved in training them, and then they say, oh, but we never thought they'd do anything like this. So often these terrorist groups, I think, don't arise whole cloth. But here's another interesting piece of information relating back to 11-22-63. The communications of Air Force One that day, and we still don't have the full transcript of the Air Force One communications, but the company in charge of all of the ground relays subcontracting to the Pentagon to relay the radio signals as the plane flew across the country was Collins Radio. And some of the researchers know Bill Kelly's done a lot of work on Collins, that there's key characters at Collins that interrelate to the Kennedy assassination scenario. But they were the ones in charge. Now, subsequently, Collins Radio was bought out by Rockwell International. And there was a flap some years ago, and I don't know if you remember this, about the NRO. This is an agency that used to be so secret, its initials were secret. But it's called the National Reconnaissance Organization. And its responsibility is satellite photography and analyzing satellite photography. And it's still very top secret. They arranged to use black budget secreted funds in order to build a multi-building complex out in Langley in Virginia, unbeknownst to the Congress. And at some point, it got to be known. I don't remember how. There was in some testimony it came out, and Congress was outraged that they were using these surreptitious funds to build building that the Congress had never improved, this, you know, multi-million dollar building complex. Well, the funnel of funds, in other words, how they were paying for the building and secreting it, was through Collins Radio Rockwell for the NRO. And this was in the late 90s, mid to late 90s. I would suggest that Collins Radio probably still subcontracts those communications and may have been involved in the cutting off of Bush from communications on September 11th. It's only a speculation, but I think it's worth a follow-up. And another piece is that I've got this little article that Lou Wolf from Covert Action came across. And there's two pieces. This is Rudolph Giuliani is in Chicago, and he's leading a Homeland Security event, and you're invited to attend. And this was September the 6th this year, by some sort of a security operation, the NLSI, but it's some sort of national association of security and police and government people and healthcare professionals emergency response and city councils are inviting all these people to come. And besides Giuliani, there's another major speaker named John Fulton, who's with the CIA, and he's going to discuss intelligence gathering and analysis of the future of homeland security. And then they're also going to announce their development. NLSI has come up with the SafeStar Homeland Security Command Center to support public safety and health officials. So they've got some product to sell. And they mention in here this incident that Fulton was involved with on the morning of September 11, 2001. And then there's also a UPI story about it that calls it a bizarre coincidence. And on that morning, Fulton was at the buildings of the NRO, these secret buildings that were built without congressional, and they were going to have an exercise that morning, a pre-planned simulation to explore the emergency response issues that would be created if a plane were to strike a building. And the UPI said it was bizarre, and that Dulles, where one of these planes took off that were involved in the September 11, was only 4 miles away. Little did they know that the scenario would come true in a dramatic way that same day. And he was going to speak about counterterrorism information gathering and how it works for today's systems and countering terrorism for tomorrow. This counterterrorism thing, and that's what I talked about in 96, has become a cover for them planning out these various scenarios, real or not, either letting them happen or creating them in order to give themselves the excuse for the improper response. Take it a step further about the current investigation and these interlinks. There was a guy named Mormar Ahmad who was the head of Pakistani intelligence, which had been the funnel for many years to the Mujahideen for the CIA of funds and weapons, and also he had been a direct funnel to Osama bin Laden during the time when the U.S. was openly supporting bin Laden in the Afghan war and his circles. So he knew bin Laden well, and he was on September 11th still the head of Pakistani intelligence. When he went back into Pakistan, he was out of the country that day, in October, his head rolled. They took him out. They didn't take out anybody under him, but they removed him for being too close to bin Laden, and also because a story had been revealed in the Indian press about $100,000 that he had passed through a subsidiary agent to Muhammad Atta, who is supposed to be the mastermind of 9/11, when Atta was living in Florida. And Muhammad Atta got this $100,000 through this intermediary person, Saeed. And that person, the intermediary for the funding from Mormar Ahmad, the head of Pakistan intelligence, to Atta, and this was in August when the funds passed, in August of 2001, so a month before $100,000 goes across. And the guy who's the intermediary to bring the funds to Atta or get them there by bank account or something is the guy who's now been convicted of killing Richard Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter. The Wall Street Journal was also the only major press outlet that broke this story of the $100,000. And Pearl, according to, I know people that know him in D.C., and I know others that were working with him, and the inside story on Pearl was that he was looking into ongoing U.S. interrelations with bin Laden and this stuff at the time that he was kidnapped and murdered. So on to the wrong story, I think. But in any case, this $100,000 passes to Atta in Florida. And Mormar Ahmad, on September the 4th, is in the United States. And he's meeting with officials at Langley, according to the press, in other words, the CIA. He's also having meetings with other people. On the morning of September the 11th, this guy, the head of Pakistani intelligence with ties to bin Laden, is discussing the threat of terrorism from abroad with two U.S. government officials named Porter Goss and Bob Graham. They're both from Florida, and one, even though one's a Democrat, the other's a Republican, one got the other into office, and they respectively head the Senate and House intelligence committees that are now investigating 9/11 as an intelligence failure. So the morning of September 11th, they're having breakfast with the guy that passed $100,000 in August, a month before, to the mastermind of the event, if the official story is to be believed. In addition to that, I think it's important to remember that, as I say, this was a Casey operation, and Casey was behind the funding, and Casey also ran, as you remember, the Contragate operation, and all the funding and surreptitious stuff around that. So these are two Casey operations spreading out from the same base. Now, a lot of the people that were involved in the Contragate scandal around Oliver North are now back in power. John Poindexter has been put in charge of data mining all computers in the United States and tapping all the phones at this Office of Information Advancement or something. I don't know, it's a special new office that was created. Otto Reich from part of the Contragate operations out of the State Department is back in. The guy who was actually the ambassador down there to the country at the time who ran the Contra covert operations just before September 11th was in Byelorussia running, according to the international press, an operation just as big as the Contragate operation in Byelorussia, White Russia, to defeat a left-leaning or communist candidate who was running for office there and continuing this pattern. And there are others. There's four or five of these former Contragate people are back up in high positions within the Bush administration. Well, there's a Sarasota, Florida newspaper that pointed out that when Mohammed Atta was living in Florida, he was rooming with one of the Iran-Contra pilots. There's another story now that two of the supposed terrorists who did this hijacking were living with an FBI informant in the same apartment. And we have that kind of pretext in 93 when they were involved in bombing the trade towers for the first time because there was an FBI informant who actually told the FBI about these plans to build explosive and attack the towers and whether he should intervene, and they told him, no, don't intervene, don't interfere with the operation, and then, you know, the explosion happened. So there was another whole circle around with this. I mean, of course, if you clip backwards to November of 2000, you have probably the most blatant grab for power since the Kennedy assassination, where we have finally the phony democracy here in the United States rubbed in our face. And the rest of the world, at first I couldn't figure out why Gore stepped out of the script, because my whole